here. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, what can we expect if and when gray wolves come off of the federal endangered species list? We'll talk to a state DNR biologist about state protections for the species. First, in 1976, Ronald Reagan lost the Republican presidential nomination to Gerald Ford, the party's sitting president. He was dismissed as too ideological and too old to be president. 8 years later, he swept the national election for his second term as president of the United States, winning all but one state. Our next guest has been chronicling what changed in American culture and politics during that time. Over a series of four books, he's documented the rise of conservatism in America. He's here to share his latest about the years leading up to Reagan's election. Rick Perlstein is a journalist, columnist, and author of Reaganland, America's Right Turn, 1976 to 1980. Rick, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be here, Rob. You know, driving around as a very nerdy high school student in Milwaukee when growing up, I would listen to WHAD and I would always, you know, dream of being one of the authors who was interviewed, you and Terry Gross on WUWM. So, you know, it's always a pleasure coming back to the Ideas Network.
Well, you've reached the pinnacle now. There's nowhere to go but down from here, I guess.
Well, every year, is needed or not.
Well, you pack a lot into this new book, but I want to go even wider and talk about your project going from kind of the mid-1960s after Barry Goldwater got beaten in the presidential election up to the 1980s. Talk about this long-term project to trace the rise of conservatism.
Yeah, I've been working on this since 1997, so I've finished it up with this book. It's 23 years. It actually starts in the late 1950s when it's pretty much conventional wisdom that conservatism is not really relevant in American politics, that we're a center-left nation, that we're becoming a nation in which, you know, the government takes care of more and more basic functions like, you know, we're now familiar with in Northern and Western Europe, that America is on its way to kind of ending its racial ordeal. And that people like Barry Goldwater, who was the guy who ended up winning the Republican nomination in 1964, were utter irrelevancies. So the first book I wrote about this was called Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater and the Unmaking of the American Consensus. And it's about how Goldwater won that nomination, and it ends with his landslide loss against Lyndon Johnson. And the last page of the book is all these pundits saying that the Republican Party is literally dead as a part of American political life unless they purge the conservatives, which is pretty much what happens at the beginning of this book after Jimmy Carter wins in 1976. And in between, I wrote a book called Nixonland, which was about how Richard Nixon really revitalized the appeal of the American right by weaponizing the resentments and fears of white middle class Americans. And then the book in between is called The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan. And it again finds the Republican Party being counted down and out because of Watergate and the Watergate class of Democratic congressmen that brought Congress to a 2-to-1 Democratic majority. You see a pattern here. That was about Ronald Reagan's first run for president in 1976. And then this book starts right where that left off, with one pundit saying that Ronald Reagan has about as much chance of becoming a presidential contender as Richard Nixon.
And you trace this concerted effort to take the Goldwater ideology in many ways and make it dominant ultimately in the Republican Party, and then to take that Republican Party and win elections. And there's one phrase that keeps, I guess, echoing through this book of one of the organizers of this effort: we organize discontent. Can you break that phrase down for us and talk about how that played out?
So Barry Goldwater, you know, loses in this terrible landslide, and he's the guy who just absolutely says exactly what's on his mind and exactly what he wants to do for the country. So when he writes this book called Conscience of a Conservative, which sells millions of copies, but mostly only to conservatives, he says he's for ending all agriculture subsidies. He's for ending the progressive income tax. He says that Brown versus the Board of Education is not based on sound law. He says we have to be willing to risk a nuclear war against the Soviet Union, and that the only reason we don't is because a craven fear of death has crept into the American the American public. And, you know, conservatives love this, and they basically take over the party from the ground up, but in a very sort of conspiratorial way. It's not like a majority of Republicans want these kind of views. They use the rules and they pretty much assume that the public, once they hear these ideas, will somehow fall in love with them. And of course, it's an utter flop. The big difference in the people who are organizing as conservatives in Jimmy Carter's presidency, they call themselves the New Right, is they realize that they can take the American public's much more broad-based fear and anxiety over the social changes of the 1960s, their fears about things like gay rights, their fears about things like feminism, their fears about things like crime and law and order in the form of gun control legislation, which, of course, they oppose. If they can take the public exactly where they are, even to stoke up those resentments, stoke up those fears, which they do with great aplomb, they can kind of seduce them into voting for candidates who do the stuff Barry Goldwater wanted to do, but have a much more broad mass appeal. And it works really well, to the extent that not only does Ronald Reagan win the presidency in a landslide in 1980, he does so with a preponderance of what are then called Reagan Democrats, who are former Democratic voters. Often they're union members. They're from places like Milwaukee. And they're people who are terrified of, their daughters getting pregnant or their sons saying they're gay and all that sort of stuff.
Talking to Rick Perlstein about his new book, Reaganland, America's Right Turn, 1976 to 1980. And Rick, you trace all these different groups, social groups and organizations that hadn't necessarily been overt political players in the 70s. Okay. They emerged as key election shaping forces, including evangelical Christianity, which Jimmy Carter did okay with evangelical Christians. Then what happened?
Yeah, it's a really interesting and ironic story. So you got to understand that evangelical Christians, fundamentalist Christians, basically categories that overlap. They might have been very culturally conservative in the way they lived their lives and the way they saw their world. But one thing they generally were not were political activists or even sometimes voters. There's a line in Romans enjoining Christians to cast their eyes above and not care about worldly things. And that was basically taken as an injunction to not get yourself messed up with politics, right? That's for Caesar, right? It's not the Lord's. And one result of all these social changes is that all these discontents begin to take political form because preachers, first of all, they completely give up something that was very dominant among conservative Christianity previous to this period, which was a contention over theology, right? So so Southern Baptists decide they're not going to be mad at Pentecostals. Pentecostals decide they're not going to be mad at Mormons. They'll even work with Jews because the task is seen as so monumental to beat back the satanic forces of liberalism. So you have a bunch of very charismatic television preachers and a bunch of political organizers who are kind of working behind the scenes who are doing things like, for example, leading initiative campaigns on ballots around the country to repeal gay rights laws. You have Christians who are saying that the government doesn't have a right to regulate their schools. And the watershed for this is in 1979, when Jimmy Carter's IRS commissioner tightens up the rules for private schools that have basically sprung up in profusion since the 1960s because parents want to protect their kids from what they see as the snares of liberalism. They tighten the rules to prove that your school is not segregating. And it's not necessarily that these schools don't want to have Black students. In fact, I document that a lot of them went through extraordinary efforts to recruit Black students. But for example, in the South, a lot of these same preachers in the 1950s have been segregationist leaders, so Blacks didn't want to have anything to do with them. You know, they were very proud of the struggle to have been able to enter integrated public schools. But these preachers absolutely freak out at the idea that the government is telling them to run what they consider as adjuncts of their ministries and their churches. And that really is the watershed moment in which any kind of compunctions that preachers have of basically turning their churches into precinct organizations washes away. And a lot of that is financial, because what the IRS seems to be threatening is their tax exemptions. And without their tax exemptions, they're not going to be able to make their payrolls and all the rest. So I take the reader to this absolutely galvanizing, absolutely insane administrative hearing with the IRS, in which preacher after preacher stands up and says that they're willing to go to jail, they're willing to die to fight for their right, not to fill out government forms and that sort of thing. And of course, by the next year, these preachers are all organizing their congregations to vote for Ronald Reagan, even though 4 years before, Jimmy Carter was really the first evangelical to run for president. But by that time, he's thrown his lot in with, for example, the movement to pass the Equal Rights Amendment, which is one of the galvanizing discontents that conservatives are organizing around. So Jimmy Carter had once been this evangelical hero, but he was a very old-fashioned evangelical in that he refused to base his legislating based on his understanding of scripture. It certainly informed his moral judgment, but the people who were saying that, for example, gay rights are unbiblical, Jimmy Carter was a mild supporter of gay rights, that sort of thing.
Rick Perlstein is the author of several books on the conservative movement. We're talking about his latest, Reaganland, America's Right Turn, 1976 to 1980. We want to hear from you. What do you remember about the transition from President Carter to President Reagan? Were you politically engaged and active at the time? Were you inspired to get into politics because of Ronald Reagan or another political figure of that era? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the rise of Ronald Reagan and the forces that shaped modern American conservative politics with Rick Perlstein, the author of several books on the topic. His latest is Reaganland, America's Right Turn, 1976 to 1980. What do you remember about the Reagan era? How did conservatism change with the 40th U.S. president? Do you see any parallels between Ronald Reagan and President Trump? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. Rick, we were just talking about a change in evangelical Christian voters. Another big change, I hadn't realized this till I read it in your book, the first endorsement of a presidential candidate by the National Rifle Association, Ronald Reagan, in 1980. They underwent a big change in direction in the time period you cover in your book.
Yeah, that's a really interesting story. The National Rifle Association began after the Civil War by former Civil War officers who were afraid that the marksmanship of American men was not up to snuff. So, the next time a war came, we wouldn't be able to shoot straight. And it really had nothing to do with gun control at first. And all the way through most of the 20th century, it was basically what you joined if you wanted to, be a hunter and you wanted to learn about guns. And, the American Rifleman magazine was mostly about outdoorsmen and, target shooting. It was only with the rise in crime in the late 1960s and things like urban riots that you began to see a faction of the National Rifle Association organizing against gun control, whereas the people who were running the organization were pretty much supportive of things like mild gun control, banning what were then called Saturday night specials, which were, cheap handguns that were believed to be preponderantly used in the commission of crimes. And you begin to see a faction organizing sedulously underground to take over the organization and turn it into a political machine for opposing all gun control. And the guy who's the head of this faction is this crazy, colorful guy named Harlan Carter, whose nickname is Bullethead. It was later revealed that he had been convicted of murdering a young Mexican immigrant that his family had believed had stealed poultry or something like that. The conviction was overturned on a technicality, but this guy was, like Charlton Heston, avant la lettre. And what they did was at the 1977 meeting, they used all sorts of procedural tricks and parliamentary tricks to undermine the leaders of the organization. And at 2 a.m., after, all these kind of points of order and all the different things you do to take over a meeting, The smoke clears and these guys are in charge and they fire the entire staff. And they basically say, if you're interested in anything other than getting all the gun control laws out the books, you shouldn't be in our organization. And that becomes one of the many struts of this new right-wing coalition. And one of the people who had always been advocating for this was Ronald Reagan. So Ronald Reagan, after he was governor of California, basically he made a living by lecturing and doing a newspaper column and also doing a daily radio broadcast. And one of the radio broadcasts he gave in 1975 that I listened to in the archives, he said something that would become very familiar in the decades to come, which is that when you outlaw guns, the only people to have guns are outlaws. So this idea that this was all about disarming the good guys, and you know, he would talk about, you know, the reason we have the Second Amendment is to protect ourselves from a tyrannical central government. And this kind of macho kind of John Wayne mentality becomes part of the Republican coalition, such that by 1980, yes, just like you say, the National Rifle Association for the first time says, yeah, we got a dog in this fight. You know, Ronald Reagan is for us. Jimmy Carter is against us. That was yet one more of these discontents that this new right political faction was organizing in order to unhorse liberalism in American politics.
Let's bring on a call. Sarah is with us in Zion, Illinois. Sarah, hi.
Hey, Rob. Well, for some reason, this is funny to me. I just remember being 16 and Reagan and I guess what was Carter up for re-election that year. And then and I just really didn't like Reagan. I can't remember exactly why, but I'm sure it was for environmental things. And there was a candidate here in Illinois named John Anderson, who I just really liked. And he was kind of a Republican, but he was into like conserving gas. So I was really for him. But then in 84, when Reagan was reelected, that was the first time I got a little bit involved. And I remember I wrote letters to the editor and I was like talking to people. And then I was just so depressed. And my issues would be like Central America and then environment again.
Yes.
Sarah, thanks a lot for the call. Rick, I think it's fair to say Reagan probably got a lot of people involved in politics for him or against him.
Absolutely. He was a very polarizing figure. He certainly got a rise out of John Anderson from Rockford, Illinois. He's a really interesting figure because he had actually been an early adapter, shall we say, of Christian right politics. When he came to Congress in the 1960s, he actually introduced an amendment to the Constitution to make Christianity the official language of the United States. But he just kind of became more and more left-wing. He was a Republican, but he was very disgusted with the Vietnam War. He was very excited about the civil rights movement. And by 1968, he's a liberal. And they say every 2 years, you can tell when it's election time in Rockford, Illinois, because John Anderson cuts his hair, right? Because in Washington, he was a liberal, but you know, this was making him more and more alienated from the conservatives in Rockford, Illinois. But he was a very prominent Republican. He was the House Whip, and he was beloved by reporters. He was quite brilliant. He was quite eloquent. And in 1978, he got the political scare of his life because one of these early preachers, a guy named Lyons, challenges him for his nomination for reelection for his, like, you know, 20th term. And John Anderson almost loses. And he realized that the Republican Party is being taken over by forces he hardly recognizes in the form of these right-wing preachers and all the rest. And so he runs for president. And in 1980, there's a very crowded field. You have about a dozen candidates at the beginning because Jimmy Carter seems to be such a weak president. But only one of them, John Anderson, represents what is actually a very long and distinguished strain of Republican liberalism. And he just is handed defeat after defeat. And then he decides that the public is so dissatisfied with both choices on the ballot for 1980 that maybe he can run as an independent. So he does manage to get on the ballot in all 50 states. And he Sarah's right. His main campaign promise was a 50-cent gas tax, you know, to encourage preservation, with a kind of 50% kind of rebate of the payroll tax. And he was very popular among kind of media elites. Walter Cronkite fell in love with him. He almost sounds like a partisan on the CBS Evening News. And there's once an article in the New Republic that Walter Cronkite had agreed to become John Anderson's running mate. But anyway, long story short, John Anderson gets about 8% of the vote, and a lot of that vote comes from Jimmy Carter, because John Anderson, by election day, is even more disgusted with Jimmy Carter than he is for Ronald Reagan. And one place he wins is New York State. One place Ronald Reagan wins is New York State. And that's almost certainly because John Anderson took so many votes from Ronald Reagan. Jimmy Carter.
Thanks a lot for that call. Just 30 seconds or so left. Rick, where do you go from here? This has been a long project for you with these multiple books on this long, evolving story.
I think I'm going to write a shorter book, kind of concanting the wisdom I've derived about, you know, how the Republican Party operates and how liberals like me can defeat it in future elections.
And just briefly, so much of the landscape we take for granted now, it evolved in this time period that you just wrapped up in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, and that's when I was growing up. You know, I talk about in the book, I talk about Star Wars, I talk about Superman, all these movies in which the public was kind of longing for these narratives of innocence, good guys and bad guys, instead of the kind of moral ambiguities of the earlier 70s.
Rick, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
Rick Perlstein is a journalist, columnist, and author of several books on American conservatism. His latest is Reaganland, America's Right Turn, 1976 to 1980. Coming up after the news, we'll look at how the state DNR measures and manages Wisconsin's gray wolf population and how delisting the animal from the Federal Endangered Species Act could change things in the future. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests help out with our Halloween planning and share ways to have fun and stay safe during the pandemic. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, as it stands, the gray wolf is considered endangered in the lower 48 states. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service proposed last year removing the wolves from federal protection, saying that wolf populations had recovered. The change would hand management back to states and Native American groups. It's a guessing game when that delisting could actually happen. A past effort to delist the wolf was ultimately overturned in the court system. You could join this conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think gray wolves should be taken off the endangered species list? Why or why not? What personal experiences have you had with wolves, especially here in Wisconsin? And what would you like to know about how they're managed in the state? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Randy Johnson is the large carnivore specialist for Wisconsin's DNR. Randy, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rob. Good to be here.
We got a new wolf monitoring report, I understand, from the DNR earlier this year. Give us the basics of our gray wolf population in Wisconsin and how it's doing today.
Sure. Yeah. So the results from last winter's annual wolf survey continue to show a very healthy wolf population here in the state. The minimum count came out to be 1,034 animals in the state. And again, that is considered a minimum count because it's done in the winter time, you know, before pups are born, that type of thing. So that is actually a bit of a jump from the previous few years where we were looking at closer to 900 animals. But you know, the jump, I think it just further reinforces that we have a very healthy and recovered wolf population here in the state.
And talk about the, fall and rise of gray wolves in the state. Where were we at our low points here?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, they're a native species. They were here historically, but for a variety of reasons, you know, throughout the 18 and early 1900s, wolves were all but eliminated from the state, as well as the lower 48 states altogether, with the exception of northeast Minnesota, very remote area, and some wolves hung on up there. As we progressed into the 50s and the 60s and into the 70s, we started to see some wolves come back in Wisconsin. They came back naturally. They came back on their own. And as we got into the 1980s, we started to see, you know, half a dozen packs or so, 25 some animals. And essentially every year since, we've seen growth in that population all the way to the high point of today, which is over 1,000 animals.
What did the endangered species listing do when it came to protecting those wolf populations as they were started to bounce back?
Yeah, so it offers legal protections, of course, but it also offers money to do research, those types of things, and brings recognition to the fact that they're valuable species that we want to encourage and help to facilitate their recovery. And I think to that end, it's done a really good job.
Give us a sense of where our wolves are around the state. And I know they move around a bit, but it broad strokes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Basically, they cover about a third of the state as far as the wolf range, as it's called, areas where we have resident packs of wolves. Most of that, of course, is in the northern part of the state throughout the forested region. But we do have kind of an island, if you will, of wolf habitat in the central part of the state, with kind of an extension, I guess, of the main population. That said, as you alluded to, wolves can cover ground and they're certainly capable of showing up just about anywhere in the state.
Talking to Randy Johnson, large carnivore specialist with Wisconsin's DNR, talking about the gray wolf here in the state and the prospects for removing it from the Endangered Species Act protections. Randy, there are some people in the conservation field who say, hold on, yeah, this four-digit number, that's good news, and it meets those targets. But they say, looking back, pre-European settlement, it's not comparable to the numbers we had before. The ranges aren't as wide as they were in those times. And there's an argument that maybe we need those higher numbers and those wider ranges to really have long-term stability for the species. And that's the argument, I think, in broad strokes, against getting rid of those protections. What do you say to those concerns?
Sure. Yeah. No, that is the basis of the other argument. And to that, I would also offer that the landscape has changed, obviously very much so since those pre-colonization days. So as far as, where we expect to see wolves and the amount of suitable habitat in the state that, wolves can go about their daily lives without too much interference from humans. We have indications from several years worth of survey data that shows that most of that suitable habitat is occupied in the state. And as they continue to try to expand into other areas of the state that are more agricultural or more human dominated, it's just cause for concern, both on the human side as well as the wolf side. So, trying to anticipate wolves across the whole state, I just don't know that it's a very realistic option.
Now, there have been federal efforts to delist the gray wolf in some states, including Wisconsin, and there's been some bipartisan support from that from members of Congress. I believe both of our senators from both parties. There's an effort in the House as well. However we got there, though, if the gray wolf was delisted here in the state, what on a practical level would that mean for Wisconsin?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, I think delisting should be considered, a conservation success. Again, we look back, it was not that long ago that wolves were essentially gone from the state. And now we have a native species that has come back. It's fulfilling its ecological role. They have a lot of cultural value. And I think that should be seen as a success. But along with that, I think it should be seen as a realization that this is a top level carnivore that can and does cause issues in some situations, and some level of management is appropriate. So upon delisting, that means, as you mentioned earlier, that management authority would come back to the state, and that would give us the best ability to manage the species using all the tools available to try to really find that balance between a healthy and sustainable wolf population, but also addressing those social concerns and those, livestock concerns, those types of things, where and when needed.
You just wanted to use the word I wanted to get into next, livestock. That is one point of conflict here, that there are people with livestock, dairy cows, among others, who are worried about wolf depredation and say that the endangered species listing kind of ties their hands. What would change, especially for that livestock situation?
Sure. Yeah. You know, right now we do have a variety of methods available to help assist livestock producers and farmers that are experiencing issues. We have a whole variety of non-lethal techniques that we use, and in many cases they are successful. We offer, you know, technical advice, different techniques. However, wolves are smart. You know, the packs learn, they adapt, and in some cases, they learn that those non-lethal techniques, you know, they're not bothering them. And, you know, to really offer relief in those situations, we need to look at lethal control. You know, and sometimes that means removal of one individual from the pack, and that solves the problem, all the way to the extreme of potentially the whole pack. But even in those limited cases, that would not put the population as a whole in any sort of endangerment.
We're talking about wolves in Wisconsin, gray wolves in Wisconsin, and what it could look like if they were taken off the endangered species list. Randy Johnson is with us, large carnivore specialist with the State Department of Natural Resources. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the gray wolf should be taken off the endangered species list, those protections removed in Wisconsin? What kind of a management would you like to see of gray wolves here in the state? If you are a farmer who's had interactions with wolves, for better or worse, I'd like to hear your story as well. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with DNR large carnivore specialist Randy Johnson about gray wolves in Wisconsin, how we monitor them, and what it might look like if the wolves were taken off the endangered species list and those protections removed here in the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions about gray wolves here in the state, what federal protections mean, what the state might do to manage wolves if those endangered species protections were removed. Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Norm is with us in Oneida County. Norm, hello.
Yeah, hi, Randy. I have a question on what they call the Threatened Species Act. Last time the wolves were taken off the Endangered Species Act, they were really hunted and slaughtered. On the Threatened Species Act, my understanding is wildlife services would have the authority to deal with problem wolves, but there would not be a hunting season on wolves. And certainly there are things farmers can do to prevent these attacks. Thank you.
Norm, thanks for the call. Randy, threatened species, and would hunting be a possibility again?
Yeah, so I think what he's referring to there would be a change in status under the Endangered Species Act, going from endangered to the lesser classification of threatened. This would be similar to the current status of wolves in Minnesota, which he alluded to would keep federal protections, but they'd be a little bit looser. They would allow for lethal control in certain situations, again, regarding livestock and depredations. That's very similar to what's in place over in Minnesota. So when it comes to a harvest season here in Wisconsin, again, if they were on the endangered species list, we'd really have no management authority in that case, with the exception of a little more flexibility with depredation.
Thanks a lot for the call, Norm. We'll go to Deb now in Green Bay. Deb, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I feel torn. It's sad to hear that the wolves are doing that well to be taken off the endangered species list. So, you know, I understand that there's two sides to the story. But when your guest talks about lethal control, what does that look like? What's allowed? Are the traps allowed that, you know, trap a leg of a wolf and they stay there, you know, being tortured for days? Are those kinds of things allowed for lethal control?
Deb, thanks for the call. Randy?
Yeah, no, I should clarify that, you know, we have a staff of professional biologists that, you know, take great care. And again, those situations are not necessarily the preferred alternative, but only needed or only used when needed. When those situations are used, we have regulations on where traps can be placed, how often they must be checked, a whole suite of things to make sure that it's as humane as possible.
Thanks a lot for that call. Is there a thought about making sure we humans are well-trained in our interactions with wolves to prevent as much as we can negative interactions? I remember a conversation a couple years ago about how, you know, the way cow carcasses are disposed of, for example, might be luring wolves to livestock areas elsewhere in the country. Can we be better neighbors for wolves ourselves?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point. Education is a huge part of this. Again, you know, when it comes to livestock carcasses, those types of things, that's certainly part of a lot of the technical advice that's offered. Similar ideas would be, you know, improving fence structures, clearing brush back away from the fences, you know, to make it less enticing for wolves and those types of things. But that extends out to, you know, to citizens as well, you know, trying to keep wolves from becoming habituated around people or anything like that, you know, and learning some of the realities, you know, as far as what living with wolves looks like.
Can you talk about the role of the gray wolf as an apex predator in our Wisconsin ecosystems? What function does it serve there?
Sure. Yeah. You know, again, they're a top level carnivore. Their primary prey across the state is white-tailed deer. You know, but there's other things that are included in their diet as well. Things like, like beaver, for example, turkey, those types of things. And, you know, they really serve, kind of a policing role in many cases, if you will, where they keep those prey numbers, in check, which is important to allow for healthy forest. There's certain, you know, plant species that are really sensitive to over-browsing by deer and other critters. And some of those, both by preying on, you know, and eliminating certain numbers, but also changing their behavior, making them more wary, shifting where they're feeding, those types of things, can really influence the vegetation on the ground. But also their kills serve as, you know, a source of food for other species as well. Things like all kinds of different bird species, different insects, you know, all those nutrients are returned and fed upon by a variety of wildlife as well.
In our last 30 seconds or so, Randy, delisting is a maybe and who knows when kind of scenario. Does that make it hard to plan between that and who knows what the state legislature might do from year to year? Is it tough to plan for if and when it happens?
Yeah, you know, you bring up a good point, and that is that the decision date, when that might become effective, when it might come down, that is, you know, that is kind of a moving target at this point, and it remains unknown. As far as the DNR, you know, we're trying to be as prepared as possible, but recognizing that, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty at this point, and what those next steps will be shaped when that decision comes. But one thing I'd like to just make clear is that when a species is removed from the Endangered Species Act, it's not necessarily just unprotected, right? We will still have state law, we'll have regulations as to when any of those animals could be harvested, if a season were to take place. Again, all of the things we talked about with depredation, they will remain protected, and I don't think there's any real threat of becoming endangered again down the road.
Randy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you.
Randy Johnson is the large carnivore specialist at the Wisconsin DNR. We talked to him today about the current health of Wisconsin's gray wolf population and what things could look like if and when the gray wolf comes off the endangered species list. The public is less cautious about the coronavirus pandemic now than they were this spring. But for voters at the high risk of COVID-19, the disease is just as deadly. Wisconsin has made big strides since the April election to make absentee voting easier. But as Corrine Hess reports, some worry that the challenges they faced in the spring could keep them from voting in November.
For Crystal and Teron Edwards, voting has always been a priority. But in April, they decided it could be dangerous for them to go to the polls. Teron Edwards is a diabetic. Two of their children have spinal bifida and asthma. All three would have been at more risk for severe symptoms if they caught COVID-19. So the couple planned to vote absentee. but they never received their ballots. The experience left Crystal feeling like the system's broken.
It's like I could literally go on Google or YouTube and I could learn how to fix my dryer, but there is no instructional video on how to fill out an absentee ballot.
Crystal and Teron Edwards were among more than a dozen Wisconsin plaintiffs who filed a lawsuit trying to change several provisions of Wisconsin's voter ID law for the next election. They included a requirement that people voting absentee by mail get another person to witness their signature. Federal Judge William Conley granted a request to extend the deadline for counting absentee ballots by 6 days and extend the online and mail-in registration deadlines by a week, but he rejected an attempt to waive voter ID requirements.
Whatever the problem was with the uncertainty of COVID-19 for a few weeks, where people might have locked their door and not seen anyone for a month or more, we're well past that now.
The Wisconsin Elections Commission has created new strategies since the April election aimed at calming people's fears. Absentee ballot applications have been sent to 2.6 million registered voters, and municipal clerks are scaling up staffing and adding drop boxes. Dean Knutson is a former Republican state representative from Hudson who now serves on the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Knutson, who helped pass voter ID when he was in the legislature, says the unprecedented increase in absentee ballots in April did lead to some trouble for less tech-savvy voters who had trouble uploading their photos. That's why the mass mailing was sent out, explaining to voters their options.
That you can go vote in person and do an absentee ballot where someone's actually there both to be your witness and to help guide you through the process. And that's been available for a long time, but many voters have never taken advantage of it.
Knutson says Wisconsin has run in-person elections smoothly during the pandemic, so anyone who's worried should head to the polls during early voting or on election day.
So unless you're elderly or a particularly vulnerable individual health concerns that would make COVID a greater risk for you, I mean, anybody that's uncertain about voting absentee should avail themselves of their right to go vote in person.
Wisconsin's April election broke records when more than 960,000 people voted by mail. Already, nearly a 500,000 ballots have been returned for the November election. Milwaukee resident William Lasky is another plaintiff in the election lawsuit. He has a respiratory disease and is on oxygen. He says he requested but never received his absentee ballot for the April election, but he says he's not missing the November election.
This one is terribly important. I think I will chance my life if I have to go and vote one way or the other. I mean, I think that's how important this election is.
Lasky says he's hoping to vote absentee this year, but no matter what, he's voting. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, with a big change in the works in the U.S. Supreme Court, two justices say they want to take another look at same-sex marriage and religious liberty. We'll get the latest, and you can share your thoughts. Wisconsin is seeing some big jumps in COVID-19 positive tests and hospitalizations. Records in both of those categories set today. A public health expert joins the show to talk about what's behind the latest numbers and answer some of your questions. And Jacques Pepin brings us ideas and inspiration for simple, quick, and delicious meals on this week's edition of Food Friday. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Trick or treating is going to work differently in most Wisconsin communities this year on Halloween because of the pandemic. But one way or another, there's still a lot of Halloween candy for sale, which means I have some decisions to make at the grocery store. To buy or not to buy, that's the question. Producer Laura Pavin is pondering similar questions. Hey, Laura.
Hey, Rob.
Well, I'm trying to figure out, do I need to stock up on candy and figure out a safe way to deliver it? If I'm not giving it away, do I want to buy it for, you know, us to eat? Are you going through the same stuff?
I'm going through the same thought process, although I think I'm being a little bit trickier with it because I'm wondering if I just wait for the day after Halloween when it's like 90% off and just purchase all of it. But I also have an 8-month-old daughter, which, you know, I feel like I basically had for this sort of question. So I could just kind of tote her along and then grab candy from bowls and then just keep it all for myself.
Aha. Uh-huh. So using your little kid as a front to sneak some That's candy right. off of those safely distanced Halloween distribution points.
That's right.
Okay,
that
I'm
right.
already getting grocery requests from my kids, older kids, for a certain peanut butter and chocolate popular sure. candy. How about you?
Oh, I love like king size Reese's, king size Snickers, king size anything really is very good for me. There's also a crunchy peanut butter Reese's, which I tweeted to.
Happy Halloween in advance. Got to jump in, Laura. This is Central Time.
Yeah. Okay.